Mackenzie.
Lamar.
Speaking of my old news voice.
Your newsy voice.
That's what I imagine every news person sounded like. We're doing the network today, and we're going to get pretty heavy into media obsession, corruption in media. It's going to get pretty dark, so I want to start with something a little lighter. Pretty quick question for you. I feel like those of us our age bracket, you were one of a couple types of kids. So were you a Nickelodeon kid or a Disney kid or a Fox News kid? Which one were you?
Oh, I hate to disappoint. I was none of the above.
What?
Because Fox News is terrible. And the other two were on cable. And I did not have cable.
What did you watch? PBS?
PBS. Yeah. I was just about to say, I was a PBS kid. Watched a lot of Arthur, you know?
Oh, yeah.
That angry fist. I loved PBS Kids, to be honest. I think from a cartoon standpoint. And then on Saturday mornings, you could get cartoons. Like, if we're talking like cartoon fun kid stuff, it was like Saturday morning cartoons. You could still get like, I think it was like ABC had probably some of the Disney Family type of stuff. I don't know. It was like,
do you remember
Recess.
One of the shows that you,
yeah, like, do you remember Recess and Doug and some of those things?
Wait, Doug got put on ABC?
I don't know. One of the Saturday morning cartoons.
Because that was a Nickelodeon original, but then I know that it did get ported somewhere else. Maybe it was ABC. Yeah, you might be right.
It could have been like, so I still remember all the channels. It was 7, 18, 24, 36, 42, and 54. That was it. Those are the only options that you had. That's how few we had. And it was Fox, PBS, ABC, CBS, and the WB, which then changed to the CW. So that was it. That was it. And so it was on one of those. I think it was ABC, but yeah, it was like Recess. There were Power Rangers, there was X-Men.
Okay. So you didn't miss out on too much. Yeah, X-Men was definitely,
I think,
like
I got
Fox
all of it later is the big thing. Like, I think I just watched
okay,
a
like
lot
syndication.
Of it late. Yeah. Right. And I got like a Pink Panther, but that was super later. And what was the other one I was just thinking of? Oh, Animaniacs.
Oh, hell
you
yeah.
Know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And like Pinky and the Brain.
Yeah, those anyway. Were after school shows for me. I think they were on.
Yeah, they were on
those Fox. But I feel like I would come home from school and watch Animaniacs. But yeah. I was definitely a PBS kid to start. I grew up on Mr. Mm-hmm. Rogers, Sesame Street, all that
fuck
stuff.
Yeah.
But then quickly transitioned into Nickelodeon. I was never. We had Disney for
you
a few years.
You feel like a Nickelodeon kid,
dude,
actually.
Yeah.
They were zany as fuck, man. Some of those shows are crazy that I like
not
saw
for
later
kids at all. Yeah,
no.
Rocky's Modern Life, Ren and Stimpy, definitely not. Children's shows when you go back.
What's
and watch
the
them.
Safari Family one? That
Wild
one always seems. Yeah, that one always seemed crazy to me. Yeah,
yeah, bonkers. Yeah. That was a little past my prime Nickelodeon, but like Rugrats was my jam. Snick. I mean, I guess yeah. That
yeah,
was
Rugrats
like,
seemed crazy to me. These were all again. I saw these all either later or at other people's houses, and yeah. I was like, "This is wild."
And then, Are You Afraid of the Dark? That was my like journey into horror, becoming a big
yeah.
horror fan. Was Are
Mine
you
was
of the
Goosebumps,
dark
but that was on PBS.
Those were the, yeah, we could ask that yeah. question too, but it wouldn't have had as much to do with TV channels like this movie.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I remember all the networks. I sure do. Even that okay. edgy Fox, which is actually not Fox News, like Fox Network. Fox News came later. So, anyway,
yes,
we'll get into all that. But yeah, all right, let's roll. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm Mackenzie.
I'm Lamar.
And we are wrapping up Satire September, which I actually have really enjoyed. So
yeah.
I'm kind of sad to see it go, to be honest. But
it's kind of a niche genre. I mean, I think, yeah. not so niche that there's not a lot of options because we had 10
yeah,
or 20
lots.
Others that we could have done. Mm-hmm. But it's different from anything else we've ever done. It's been a lot of fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I'm excited. This one's going to be a good one too. I think it's, again, it's really what I think we did well this month is we picked a really good variation and representation of satires. And this one is very different. It's got tendrils of the other stuff. But this one's very
tendrils,
different, I think.
Tendrils, your favorite word.
Tendrils. I love a tendril. But yeah, it's got tendrils of those things, but it's a little bit different. So we're going to be doing Network 1976. I say that because if you look up Network movie, there's like two or three different things that might come up. So Network 1976.
Yeah. Did you figure out, was this, you had seen this before? You just didn't remember a lot of it?
I I think I have, but it's either been a very long time mm-hmm. or I hadn't seen it all the way through because there were things that seemed very familiar. And then there were parts that were like wholly new to me, it felt like. So yeah, it was kind of a mix, I think. But really quick for those who maybe haven't paid attention this month or don't know or want a refresher, satire is a genre of the visual, literary, and performing arts, usually in the form of fiction, not as often nonfiction, where vices, follies, abuses, shortcomings are held up to ridicule, usually with the intent of like shaming or exposing that flaw, whether it be of individuals, corporations, governments, society, etc. But it's intended by and large to be humorous, but the purpose is a social criticism. The idea is to criticize this thing, that society, that what have you, to hopefully fix it. And it often makes fun of that in movies and art and film, etc. So that's kind of what we're doing here.
And what's interesting about this one is the writer and director are on the record as saying they didn't think this was satire when they were making it. They thought they were accurately depicting. I think obviously when we get into what happens in the film, it gets pretty out there, but they thought they were, it was less about, hey, we're poking fun at this thing and like exaggerating it and more just like, this is the way this business is
going.
They
thought they were documenting what was happening in real time. And they were trying to...
If you didn't hear me say this last week, guys, like, it's scary how accurate this is to the way that things have become with just polarizing news networks and not even being the news anymore.
I think they were both satirizing and unintentionally satirizing, right? I think they were documenting with the intent of doing exactly what satire is trying to do, right? Which is put a light on something and make a change. But they did, I think, take parts of it objectively to an extreme that do kind of lean it into that satirical range. So I think they were being hyperbolic to make a point, and they didn't really necessarily associate that with satire. But it certainly is now when we look back at it. But anyway, we'll get into some more of that here in a minute. What are we drinking to get through this one?
We're drinking homemade Sprite is what it tastes like in a good way.
I haven't tried it yet. I keep waiting to try them.
Yeah, I saw the recipe and I was like, it reminds me of the Mitch Hedberg joke where he's like, may he rest in peace, by the way. But they say that the recipe for Sprite is lemon and lime, but I tried to make it at home and there's more to it than that. And Skylar has proven that point right, because this is 0.75 ounces of lemon juice, 0.75 ounces of lime juice, 0.75 ounces of simple syrup, 2 ounces of filtered water, and then you're going to shake and strain that into a martini glass and top it off with soda water to give it some bubbles. And yeah, it's kind of like a more natural Sprite, not as sugary as Sprite.
He also recommended edible glitter if you have it. We didn't have that, but we had like sprinkly sparkles.
So you just used real glitter.
So he put like, he put like real glitter. You can't see it or I'm going to spill.
Wait, you put real glitter in there?
Well, he put not real glitter, but like food sprinkles. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to be, we didn't have fake glitters or edible glitters, so we just put actual glitter in there, and that's what I'm drinking today.
Yeah. Can you see it? I can't see it.
I can't really see it too much.
All right. Well, I tried. He tried. We tried. All right.
This is called bullshit because bullshit. I guess I should have mentioned up front, if you didn't know, we're doing mocktails all month for our non-alcoholic listeners. More power to you. We wanted to give you some
and for
recipes.
Our livers. Let's be honest. Our livers needed a
break.
Yeah.
The title doesn't say we drink alcohol and we watch things. So to be fair, we're still on brand with this. This has been a fun month of trying new things. So we're calling this bullshit because it's said a lot in this movie. And mocktails are kind of bullshit. You're paying $14 for no booze.
They really are. They really are. All
if
right,
you make them at home, better. Cheers.
It is kind of a homemade Sprite-y. It's a little bit more, I guess, lemony or limey, whatever, citrusy. You know, it makes me think, and I don't know if this is accurate or not, but do you remember Surge?
Yeah, like the green bottle soda.
Yeah. And I don't, I cannot for the life of me remember what it tasted like, but I remember being obsessed with it. And it was supposed to be lemon limey, I think. And it looked kind of like this. And I feel like I've heard recently that it was trending again. Like people were trying to find Surge.
Like bring it back. Caramel apple empanadas are back at Taco Bell, everyone. Red alert. They've been off the menu for like 6 years, but I guess they're doing like a special menu and they brought back 10 items for a limited time. So hit up Taco Bell, people. Little plug there.
Wow. As y'all may recall, our buddy Mac, who has visited the pod before, feels strongly about my opinions about Taco Bell. And the only time he's ever yelled at me was when he yelled at me that I was ignorant because I haven't, which by the way is something nobody's ever said to me, because I hadn't tried Taco Bell in like 10 years. And he's like, well, then you're ignorant. So it was my favorite conversation. But anyway, now might be the time to go
Taco
back.
Taco Bell is a cultural hotbed of cuisine. I feel like you're missing out, but I'm not going to call you ignorant.
Thank you. Thank you. That was, I hope, a one-off in my life is my goal. All right. Well, maybe I'll go check that out. We'll see. All right. Let's get into some basics, some spoiler warnings, and then we'll have a good time. All right. Cool. So like I said, this is 1976. Been a minute. But again, very prescient. Holds true today. This was an 8.1 out of 10 on IMDb. Very, very highly rated and received, and it holds up on the Rotten Tomatoes side as well. 91% from critics, 93% from audiences. So even the audience thought higher of it and thought it was really good. It did really, you know, pretty well overall at the box office as a result as well. But we'll get into that in a second. This is directed by Mr. Sidney Lumet. So he's done some things that have been remade, so I want to be careful, but he did the originals of 12 Angry Men, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, and a few others. And then the writer here was Paddy Chayefsky, who is, first of all, incredible. Well, no spoilers there, but this is a great script, but has done some other stuff that probably most people don't know, but are, you know, were well known in the time. Marty, The Hospital. And I wanted to call out, he's a major inspiration for Aaron Sorkin.
And I could sense that watching this. Yeah.
I think that shows in Aaron Sorkin's writing and even like the cadence with which he writes. And even Faye Dunaway had mentioned, she was interviewed about this film and she said, this is the only film I didn't even try to touch the script because it's written in almost a verse. It's almost written in verse and you don't need to do anything to it. It's so poetic. So I think everyone who worked on this film and obviously in the audiences can just feel how well written it is. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah, he's also, I'm going to point this out now. I promise I'm going to do most of my interrupting today during the cast and crew list because I didn't look up a ton of facts this week on sort of the behind the scenes stuff. But I was mostly fascinated by the amount of fun Oscar trivia facts this has, as well as some of the, I don't want to call it tragedy, but just the paths folks took in the few years following this for such an incredible film. But yeah, Paddy Chayefsky, also his first name is really Sidney. So he has the same name as the director, two Sidneys on one movie set. But Paddy's a nickname, but only 3-time solo screenplay Oscar winner. The only person who's ever done that, like not counting scripts where people share or there's multiple writers, but the only person who's ever won 3 Oscars by himself as a screenwriter. Interesting.
Incredible. I love it. Okay, major cast and crew. Like I said, Faye Dunaway. She plays Diana Christensen. She's done a million things. People know her most for Mommy Dearest, and I just have to add that she hates that. She's like, I'm so sick of people asking about this one movie I did ages ago when in my entire body of work, it's not even the best movie I did. And she said that. She's been quoted as saying that was actually a really terrible time in her life. So it doesn't take her back to a good time. So I wanted to call out some of her other work, which is also incredible. Bonnie and Clyde, she's really great in. Chinatown's a great, great film. The Champ. And then a fun one that I had to throw in, which is not like the highest of quality, but I know I've mentioned it before on the pod, is I loved the TV series Alias. And okay. She plays a really good, like, goodish villain. Good bad guy in that one. And it was a fun, more recent thing okay. that she did that I
don't
cool.
I don't know much Faye Dunaway. Like, I had obviously heard her name a ton in cinema history. I don't know much of her stuff, but she blew me away in this. I love the character and I love her performance as this character. She has a very, it's funny because we did American Psycho last week and we talked a bit about Rules of Attraction, the other movie adaptation of a Bret Easton Ellis novel. She has a pretty small part, but she's in the Rules of Attraction. Like, she has like a handful of scenes in that. She's pretty good as sort of like a drugged out mom, similar to what was in American Psycho, like the female characters in that being all like lithiumed up.
Yeah, I mean, she is so dynamic, and she's very like class. She reminds me of just very classically trained actors. Mm-hmm. Like, she takes the work very seriously, and she even just really respected the director here because she was like, he was such a pro. Like, he had 2 weeks before rehearsals already like basically staged all the shots with the cinematographers. He had set everything up to be seamless where you could just focus on the work and the performance. And so, yeah, she's just such a professional. And I think she expects that too of other people around her. And this is a really pro cast getting right into that. So William Holden, lovingly known as Golden Holden, if you didn't already know that. He plays Max Schumacher. He's done a bazillion things. He won the Oscar for Stalag 17. He did Sabrina, the original, Sunset Boulevard, the original again. So he's done, and he was nominated, I think, for Sunset Boulevard as well. And then this, not for Sabrina, but he's, you know, he's a really incredible actor as well in his own right.
How does, this isn't really, well, should we throw down a spoiler warning for a 50-year-old film?
Sure. Let's just, because I don't think this is, I don't think this is one that everybody has seen, to be honest. So yeah. Anyway, turn around. Don't drown. It's spoiler time.
And go watch this movie. It's very enjoyable. And but go watch one this thing movie. I didn't enjoy. How are you feeling about this 23-year age gap between our two leads? Two of our three leads, I guess.
I mean, I think it's very intentional. You know? Yeah. I think it's supposed to be there. You know,
yeah. I wonder if it's a casting goo. Not to say that he gives a bad performance, but I do wish that they had aged him down a little bit.
I think it's supposed to be a commentary on that. I mean, there's even a few lines about that that are like, every aging fired network executive has done this thing and written this book and blah, blah, blah. Like, I think it's very intentional, and I think it's reflective of the time, and even not just the time, it happens now, right? It still happens now.
Leo.
Like these kinds of relationships. Yeah. Leo, get your shit together. but I'm just saying, like, I think, yeah, I think as awkward as it is to see and how much that we don't like it, it, I think it's unfortunately kind of accurate. So there's that. Yeah. Peter Finch, who plays Howard Beale, done many, many things as well. Most well known probably for Sunday Bloody Sunday, also The Trials of Oscar Wilde, which I always thought was really an interesting one if you haven't seen it.
And this is where I kind of want to interject here, because this was the second thing I found interesting about this, was two of the people you've already mentioned passed within 5 years of this. We mentioned William Holden, who apparently late in his career became a big drinker, and that's why I think he's 58 in this when he shoots this, and he's looking a pretty rough 58. And that's, I think, also adds to the whole 23-year age gap thing. But he passes 5 years after this due to an alcohol-related incident. He was relatively young. The writer, Patty, passes 5 years after this. I believe that was cancer. And then the worst of the bunch is Peter Finch, who died in the year following this, before the Oscars even happened. So similar to when Heath Ledger won posthumously, Peter Finch was the first person to do that. He won the Oscar and was not there because he had passed from a heart attack. And apparently he appeared on The Tonight Show the night before he died and made a joke about his bad heart and then passed away the next day. So I just found that to be like heartbreaking, for lack of a better term, and like just weird. So many people made this incredible film, and within 5 years, three of the key people were gone.
Well, and he also died. Sidney Lumet actually saw him pass. He saw him have the heart attack. And where, like, were they were meeting up at the, I think it was the Beverly Hills Hotel the day after. And he has the heart attack, and emergency services were called, and he dies in the hospital right from there. So yeah, it's very sad and almost eerie, I guess, how this carries through this cast a little bit. And yeah, how he saw that was kind of crazy. Yeah. He also, I will say, Peter Finch had a severe drinking problem as well. He was actually
that going around in the 70s and today, I guess. But
yeah, and his was a kind of pervasive throughout his career. Unlike Holden, he was known for his really incredible performances, but unfortunately, like, he was a bit notorious for his drinking, and it comes through for his character as well. They talk about it with his character of like, of course you're going to be in the bottle, you know, and and so, yeah, I think that's almost, again, another like eerie thing of very reflective of the actors themselves.
Yeah.
We also have Robert Duvall, of course, legend. He plays Frank Hackett. He's most well known for things. Well, he's most storied for things like The Apostle, Tender Mercies, etc. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention Gone in 60 Seconds. Obviously.
I like that you did what I did, because I was going to say, okay, you remember him from The Godfather Part 1 and 2. He wasn't in the best one, the third one. Sorry, guys.
Right.
But I remember him from John Q, underrated Denzel movie. I thought Robert Duvall was really good in that, too.
That is a good Denzel movie. It's sad, but it's good. But yeah, Gone in 60, he's such a vibe in Gone in 60 Seconds. He's glue. Come on, you guys. Like, it's so good. And then we have, closing us out, at least for my list, is Beatrice Straight. She plays Louise Schumacher, and most people probably don't know her for Poltergeist.
Yeah.
But she's one of the many Oscar noms in this one, and she's not on screen very long. There, she's on screen for less than, I think it's 5 minutes and something seconds.
Yep. I will knock out my Oscar facts here and bring us home, because she has the shortest screen time of any Oscar best acting winner ever. 5 minutes, 40 seconds, as you said. And God, does she crush it in like the two scenes she's in. I understand why. Also,
I was like, girl, preach. Like, she's so good. I'm just cheering her on.
I saw that and I was just like, oh man, I wish she was in the movie more, because she's crushing this scene. And then I was not surprised when I looked and saw that she'd won an Oscar for that performance, because yeah, she's great. Also worth calling out here before we get into the movie itself is that this is the last movie to have five distinct actors nominated in the main acting categories. Yep. Despite this losing, do you know what this lost the best picture to?
Rocky.
What are your thoughts on that, Mackenzie?
That's some bullshit.
That's one of those ones where you're picking a feel-good movie. I'm not saying Rocky's a bad film. Rocky is a very enjoyable film, but it is...
Rocky's a great film. Yeah. We don't have to detract from Rocky to say that that's some bullshit. like, I'm sorry. This is not... It's not the same quality. It's just not.
100%. And then the last one that I'll throw out there that I thought was interesting is, out of those five, three of them won. And those three do not share any screen time together in this film. Mm-hmm. So you have the wife, you have the Diana character, Faye Dunaway, obviously, and then you have Peter Finch. Those two never actually interact, which is surprising for how interwoven their career arcs are in this. But I just thought that was fascinating. Like, three people won Oscars and they didn't even share screen time together.
Yeah, and the last one I want to mention is Ned Beatty gets nominated for his also very short scene. Yeah. And he doesn't, I think it's a little bit less amount of time, or around the same. It's like a 5 minute mark as well. But it's just that one hefty speech, and it's so well done that he gets nominated. He doesn't win, but he does get nominated. And it's funny because he was actually a replacement. They had fired the first person, whose name I don't remember, Arthur something, but he was just not delivering it the way that he wanted. They said that he was kind of leaning too much into the mania of it all, and that Ned Beatty like really understood the kind of almost evangelical vibe that they were going for in his delivery, and that it was just night and day different. And then sure enough, he gets nominated. So pretty cool.
Reminds me of like Leo in Django, because that got him a nomination, right? Like he probably had triple the screen time of what's here. But again, just you remember that one speech. That's all you needed. Yeah.
And there's a few of these speeches in here, by the way. Again, speaking to the writing, like just incredible. Really quick plot summary, just so you guys have a framework here if you haven't seen it. A television network cynically exploits a deranged former anchor's ravings and revelations about mass media for its own profit, but it finds that his message may be difficult to control. So,
Sound familiar? That's what's
familiar.
The roughest part of watching this is just how it's become more true. You know, I know they said this wasn't satire. They were, documenting it. And it's only gotten worse, guys. When you're only getting one side of the news and you are buying into all the hateful messaging being spewed, and it's just resulting in us becoming more and more polarized on feeling like there's only two sides and two ways of thinking. And this movie isn't exactly that same, I think, thought process, because there's not multiple networks involved, but it is showing you how desperate these people are to just keep a television rating.
I think what we're seeing here that I think is really important, and again, speaking to the documentary of it all versus the satire of it all, is this was kind of shot, first of all, like a documentary, and the filmmaker was trying to do that. He was trying to show the transition from news, hard news, and documentation of facts and of life as a documentary. And that's low lighting, that's real life, there's grit, there's da-da-da. And then slowly as you watch the film progress, it's getting brighter. The lighting is more artificial, it's more polished, it's media being managed and presented and really sold to you. And I think what you're seeing is, again, somewhat prescient, but it was almost a documentary in their mind of what was happening to news media at the time. And there is a notable shift, like the advent of news for profit versus news as a public service. Like this is a historical shift in our times of it was expected for the news to take a loss. They even say that in the movie of the news was never a profitable organization of a network, but it is why the networks were given the networks, right? They were given control, similar like with the airwaves of radio. They were given control of these airwaves of these networks because they owed this service to the public. Right? You can put all this other programming on. You can make all this other money elsewhere, but you have to deliver the news. That was the unspoken, if not spoken, agreement. And what we're seeing here is a documentary that is telling you of the shift of that to be a for-profit model as well.
Yeah. And that's what we're stuck with today. Because imagine if it was just there was no Fox News or pick your channel.
CNN, and, MSNBC.
Tied into these greater networks that are concerned just about profits and ratings. Imagine if it was just objectively, here's what happened today. Form your own fucking opinions rather than talking heads and people arguing on TV and just the rhetoric that we get now. It's horrible.
And I think what we have to delineate too and call out is the effort and the education of journalists versus news networks. Right. Mm-hmm. To your point, the delivery was supposed to be as objective as possible, both in print and in news media of I have to have, you know, three verified sources. I have to give this as a fact. I have to state this as an action. I have to state this, you know, what have you. It was very clinical and objective in its delivery by and large. Right. And that was how journalists were trained. That's what they were trained to do, report the facts and only the facts. Fun fact, the hardest writing class I ever took was a journalistic writing class because it is a very specific type of writing and you are trained a certain way. And what happened and what journalists struggle with even today is that is still how they're educated. That is still how they are expected to deliver a product. And then it is editorialized in service of a network and in service of entertainment and ratings now. And yeah, that runs the gamut. And I think what was funny to me that I read about it was that George Clooney showed this movie to students and in an effort to show them this is an example of satire. Mm-hmm. And at the end of it, none of them knew it was satire. And he was really confused. He was like, why don't they get it? Why don't they think this is satire? And he was like, it turned out like, they just thought it was real because all this came true. All of this ended up happening.
This is tied into,
in their mind, is historical. Yeah.
They mention a lot of real people in this. And I almost did Google at one point, like, wait, is this a true story? And obviously as the movie went on, I was like, okay, I feel like I would have heard this if this actually did happen. But a couple call outs based on what you said. For the feel of this, wanting it to feel real, there's no music. There's no soundtrack. There's no score. The only music you hear comes from television theme songs, commercials, things that make this feel like a real universe as if you're working at this network, right? So I think,
and also the jargon, like to complement that too, like you don't walk around with a soundtrack to your life, right? Like this is almost documentary in that way as well, of there is no sound except for these theme songs and everything you mentioned, but the jargon is also intentional and somewhat alienating to the audience as well. The way they talk about the network and the analytics and the market share and all these things, you know, they asked them if they wanted to change some of the script to not have that language or to simplify it or clarify it for the audience. And they were like, no, like that's not the point. The point is for this to feel as real as possible. The audience doesn't need to know what all those things mean to understand overall what's happening here.
Big time first season of The Wire vibes when you jump in and they just do not sugarcoat anything or explain anything. You're just getting a bunch of drug dealer jargon. You're getting a bunch of cop jargon and you just kind of got to make sense with it. I also feel like this ties back to His Girl Friday a little bit, because that's got the journalism story in it and it's just like very fast paced. And again, you just have to learn how to keep up as the movie goes on. And if you're looking for the more modern day versions, I think I mentioned this last week, if you're a fan of Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal or Don't Look Up with Leo again, like the news network in that second one is very, it feels like they just pulled it from 76, this film, and like it's all about the ratings. So I think this movie definitely has ties to a lot of stuff still getting made today.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, it has ties to it. It predates it. The style of documentary vibes that evolve is also there. I really liked understanding that like the lighting was changing and the aesthetic of it was changing. And I agree with your call out about His Girl Friday too, of having that pacing, that energy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, His Girl Friday is still much faster, obviously, in terms of script here, but you feel that same almost frenetic energy here throughout the scenes, but especially the scenes that Faye Dunaway is in, right? She takes that energy away and runs with it of like, she is so hyped. She is entirely this. She's entirely this career. She's entirely this job. And William Holden, his character, tells her later, like, you are emblematic of this and the way that the news is changing and these... this entertainment and this lack of connection to the human aspect of this. And it's funny because the director told her, I know the first thing you're going to ask me is, where is this character's vulnerability? Where is her humanity in this character? And I'm telling you, there is none. He's like, there's none. Don't even try it, because I'm going to cut it in the editing room anyway. You're supposed to just play this completely straight. And they were worried about whether or not she would, right? Whether or not she would try to find some humanity in the character. And she just completely commits to the bit.
Yeah, and she crushes it. I think it's similar to when we talked about American Psycho, like Christian Bale's performance last week of like, is there humanity in there or is he just driven by this force? I think Faye Diana in this, she is a boss. She knows exactly what she wants. Mm-hmm. She knows. She has two incredible speeches in this, at least two. The first one, when she's talking about what she wants out of her news programming of, I want counterculture. I want angry news. And again, it's hitting very close to home. She's like, I want terrorism, like these things that are going to get us a rating. But I think the more impactful one is when they're out to dinner and she summarizes herself in a nutshell of she's like very impulsive. She gets into relationships that never last. She's like, I arouse quickly, I consummate prematurely, but then I'm in a rush to get my clothes back on and get out of the room. And she says, I'm inept at pretty much everything in my life except for my work. And so that's what she focuses on.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think she brings this just, like I said, this high energy, but this achiever mentality to this role. Yeah. And at first, before she kind of gives that speech, she's a bit admirable, right? You see her in this room of people who are not yet maybe taking her seriously. She says, you know, when I started this job 6 months ago. So she's still implying like she hasn't quite cut her teeth with these people yet. And they're not reading the reports that she's sent and all these things. And at the end of it, she's like, if you motherfuckers don't read these, I'm going to sack the lot of you. Like, she is cutthroat about this. You will get on this train or you will be gone. And she's also angling to make happen these things that she thinks are the vision for the network. And she'll cut down anybody to do it. And she tells William Holden this immediately, like you said, at this dinner. She tells him exactly who she is. And it's interesting to me that he still holds this semblance of humanity and romance, capital R. So he's still, even with that, just goes all in. And he almost like narrates his own downfall here a couple of times of like how this is gonna go poorly, and he does it anyway. It's kind of interesting to watch.
That part lands for me when he's constructing it as a narrative. I think that's meta in a way, and it's very smart of him to understand the situation he's in. I don't think that makes him any more likable of a character, which is probably my two biggest complaints with this. Is the William character feels, for as much as you're saying it's just something that happens all the time, it feels the flimsiest of the archetypes in this to me. He feels almost undefined. Like, he's very flexible from scene to scene, not like contradicting himself, but, and this, again, this is a first time watch through, so maybe I'm being too overly harsh, but the Holden character, for somebody that's tying everything together in this, he's sort of our through line to these three different storylines that we're getting. I don't feel any connection with him. And I especially, again, it's not just the age gap. I love how straightforward Diana is. I don't like that they eventually have her having these true heart to hearts with him and saying that she has feelings for him. Like, I don't know if she says it in those exact words, but I kind of feel like they would have been better to just have her be like, yes, I am exploiting you, or maybe not exploiting, but using you to get where I need to go. And that's exactly what this is. I think they have them lean back into the, will they, won't they, is this going to work out kind of thing. And I honestly didn't need that in here.
That's interesting, because I don't think I read it that way, especially in terms of the, like, will they, won't they. I felt like it was following the pattern and that we kind of knew that it was going to follow. And I do think she wanted to become, quote, emotionally involved with him. But kind of like we were talking about in American Psycho last week, is I think she's cosplaying a person. She knows she's not good at this. She says that out of the gate. Like, I'm not good at a relationship like this, right? But she almost wants to try and see if she feels something. It's almost experimental for her. At least that's the way it reads to me. And while I do think she has some feelings about it and would like to be with him, it feels a little bit like a conquest, you know, like an achievement. It's about being able to have a relationship with this person in particular, and less about the emotion that it's going to end up with, or getting married at the end of the day. I don't think she has that emotional goal. And he continues to say that he loves her. You never hear her say that back. Yeah. You get her feel like looking like she has some feeling here. But I think her first love is and always will be her work. And I don't think she really detracts from that at any point.
When you're screaming about ratings as you're orgasming, I guess that does imply that that's what she cares about the most.
That's all she cares about. And that is like a funny scene, but it's not, it's almost comes through as more sad than funny because of that. Like, I know it's supposed to play a little bit humorous. And even William Holden was quoted as saying, like, I think that scene on the page was funnier than it played. Like, he was like, I think it was supposed to be funny, but they had to talk him into that scene. He was like, to me, he was very old school. He was like, to me, lovemaking is private and not something that should be on the screen. And so he was very averse to filming that at all. And he said, if we had been the first to do it, I wouldn't have done it. But because other people have already done this on screen, I did it. But he thought it didn't play as funny as it was intended to play, because I do think it's kind of sad.
Yeah, you don't want work creeping into the bedroom unless you work at the same place, and then there's a little bit of role play to it. So that could be fun, I guess. but yeah, I think maybe my thoughts are also coming from, I don't like the way that Holden handles the affair. For as much as that incredible scene with Beatrice Strait is, him playing, like, being so blunt about it, of just like, yes, I'm sleeping with her, and yes, I have feelings, and then it doesn't feel like he gets any fucking comeuppance from it. He more just takes it in stride of like, yes, this is natural for a man my age to cheat on his wife, and I leave her, and then maybe she takes me back, maybe she doesn't. He seems just sort of like morose, and sort of like, maybe that's the point of the character. I just felt like those speeches didn't hit for me, because I'm like, I don't like you. I don't want to see you come out of this feeling as though you're unscathed and above it.
Yeah, I don't like him, and I don't dislike him. I like what he has to say. You know, I do like his speeches.
His defense of Howard, I like. His interactions there and trying to come to his aid. But the romance is where he loses me, that character.
Well, I do think, I think that that's a fair criticism in general about him, like his character. However, I do think it's reflective of this period and people in these types of stages of their life in this period specifically. So as blunt as he's being, I think conversations similar to this, if not quite as blunt as this, have happened in these types of relationships of like, I'm going to go have this affair and you can fuck all the way off, basically. And
that part, you know, where he says his wife, for as great as her speech is, and then he's just kind of like, you know, I'm going to go have this affair and then I'll probably wander back to you and we'll see if you take me back. That just it feels outdated. It feels like something they would have said in one of those old Humphrey Bogart films that we watched. Like, I don't know.
I think it's that she is emblematic of a male fantasy, right? Her little speech is exactly a male fantasy on paper at this time, right? Of like this woman who will just like literally have sex with me the way that I want to have sex, will not be emotional with me in the way that I don't want to have to dig into any kind of emotion. She understands my business, my career, my things. She's younger, she's beautiful, she's all these things. She's checking all these boxes at a time where he feels a sense of crisis in his life, and everything that he knows and has faith in is falling apart. So as despicable as the action itself is, and I'm not at all excusing him or that, it checks out, you know, it checks out as a as a something that would be realistic to me, at least as realistic as happening. And he, she's not classy for her part in it either. I just want to be super clear. She knows exactly what she's getting into and she's fine doing it, which I think again is a reflection on her and her values. And it doesn't help, you know, either of them, their character, you know, you respecting their character, because they don't have a ton that you respect at this point. His principles, like you said earlier, like what his speeches he gives and the way that he tries to defend and the way that he tries to stand up for his industry, the speeches themselves are pretty and beautiful, but they ring kind of hollow because he doesn't stick to his guns, right? He doesn't hold the line. He ultimately gives into this. And if he really wanted to hold the line, he would have resigned in protestation and said, like, I'm not going to do this. And instead he slowly slips until he's fired.
Yeah. You know? I think this is one where I'm probably going to have to give it a second watch. I don't want to rewatch it immediately, but I do want to give it another watch because I think I was not tracking some of sort of the business moves and, like you said, the jargon in there. So maybe it'll make more sense on a second watch. I don't want to go overly critical on this one, even though I kind of already have. But I guess, should we move on to like our third sort of lead here? Do you want to talk Howard a bit?
I mean, Howard commits to the fucking bit. Like, it is so understandable why Peter Finch was nominated. This whole speech, I'm sitting there like writing basically everything that he says down. It's so, I literally have in my notes in all caps, prescient as fuck. Like, it's predictive. It's it's eloquent, it's rageful, it's relatable, it's documentary in terms of you've seen this on the screen, and it holds true today, even in the era of not only entertainment type of news, but also social media, of course. And I love his call out of less than 3% of you read books, less than 15% of you read newspapers. This is the only truth that you know, this being the news. Television is an amusement park now. And like that stood out to me so deeply, because not only is it television, it's everything that we're looking at, and truth can be manipulated because this is the most powerful tool in the world. And he even says, imagine this in the hands of the worst person in the world. Like, this is a weapon. And that's exactly what we've seen happen.
That is, you mentioned earlier the Aaron Sorkin connection. And what was the Jeff Daniels show that he did? Was that Newsroom?
Newsroom.
And he very monologue there about like, why do you think America is the greatest country in the world? And he's like, America is not the greatest country in the world. Yeah. And he just that goes speech off is... for 5 minutes. Yeah. That I think is rooted in Sorkin's mind, probably in some of Peter's speeches in this.
Yeah. And he's like, I love this other great line. He said, we're in the boredom killing business. That's what we're trying to solve here, is the boredom that you all feel. And like, how insane is that, right? If you think about what's out there in terms of books and newspapers and like art and film and da, 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 but they're trying to solve for boredom because people won't look at those things or read those things or experience those things. And he's trying to convince us that like we're real. We're the thing that we should find excitement in and faith in, and we're the real thing. And what's funny is that you look at the audience, the whole, and I love how often they shoot to the audience while he's speaking. Of course, what he's saying and what he's doing is so compelling, so well performed, so well written. But I think it's juxtaposed against this audience that is just stoic.
They
have just zeroed in, frozen, but like listening, but not. Right? Like listening, but not absorbing, observing and being entertained, but ingesting. It doesn't look like they're getting it. Because as soon as he stops talking and he falls to the ground, they just applaud. They just applaud in mania. It's that mob mentality. And it's like, that is like the heartbreaking moment where you go, oh, it didn't work.
Yeah. He just keeps calling them out to your point about like reading books, reading newspapers. And he's like, you're just, you're staring at this screen and taking everything verbatim of this is what we're tied. It's gotten, like I said, I don't want to keep harping on this, but it's gotten worse and worse and worse. And now people are getting their news from one single source with one point of view. It's telling them to feel a certain way. And it's like, just turn off the fucking TV, dude, and like touch grass. But Howard, throughout this, it's strange to see. We've talked it throughout the month of satire typically has some comedy twinges to it. And I do think this is a funny movie at several parts, but his character throughout at the beginning, I think for a first watch, I was laughing because I was just like, this dude's getting fired. And he just straight up says, so I've decided I'm going to shoot myself next week. We'll see. Yeah. Give PR a week to hype up the show. We'll see you then.
Yeah. And we'll give PR a week to hype it up. And they're all like, go prepare for commercial 30 seconds out. You know, like nobody's listening.
Yeah. I am a sucker for a good hard cut to a technical difficulties. So I think on the second or third night when they do that, and it's just like, we need to calm him down. But like, he starts out as this sort of comedic, likable character, and you don't know how serious he's being or if it's supposed to be like sort of a dark comedic joke. But as it progresses through and he's getting more and more famous, he's also becoming more and more unhinged to the point that you feel very sympathetic to him. I didn't track at first the whole epiphany scene when he's visited in the middle of the night, but then he kind of explains it on the news the next day, and that's when he gets turned into a quote unquote prophet. And obviously we have the tragic ending for him, but I just found that journey to be probably the, maybe Diana's the most interesting part of the film, but his is definitely second to me.
I think his is, it's weird because I don't know if you got this feeling, but what I thought was interesting is I absolutely think his journey is one of the most compelling things, but because, and I think it's intentional a little bit, but because of this side story about Diana, about William, about the network, all these other factors, all these other happenings, it's almost happening in the background, even though it's very much the foreground in terms of the entertainment of it all and how central it is to the story. But it's almost noise at certain parts of the film. And it's interesting how they present it that way. And then when he comes to the front and center, he blasts through the screen practically. And then they get to that point where, like, again, they start to not be able, this golden goose starts to lay a few rotten eggs, right? Of like, oh God, is he going to keep printing us money or is he going to become a problem? And you see that devolve when his mental state is devolving as well.
When he walks in soaking wet and he just walks onto the set and sits down to do the news and he hasn't had an umbrella and he's just drenched in a trench coat. That was when I was like, oh shit, this is like, I didn't know which way this was going the whole thing. And it's like, we are supposed to pity him because he's just kind of being paraded around and speaking nonsense.
Yeah. And I think he's a circus act until this point. And it doesn't feel dangerous until this point. It doesn't feel as exploitive. I mean, it certainly is exploitative, but it doesn't feel as bad until this moment. To your point, he's, you know, got a trench coat on in his pajamas and he's like cracking up going through the set. And that's a turning point where they stay with him. Stay with him. They don't cut to technical difficulties. They go, this, you know, this is gold. That's how.
And then you get that incredible moment. I think one of the best moments, not just the speech of like the, I'm madder than hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. I had heard that referenced. I'd seen that in, you know, theater classes. So like, check out this monologue and stuff. But I do love the way that the script and the director work on this to have it staged where Max is watching it at home and kind of rolling his eyes. And it takes this slow build of Howard repeating this line over and over again. And you're seeing them cut to different places in the world, but then eventually Max hears it outside of his window. And then you get this scene of the rain pouring down, the lightning and all these angry people just shouting it out, being motivated by God knows what, and being incited. And that's a very heavy moment.
Yeah. And I think you get, it's such a heavy moment. It's so influential. It's the direct result of the thing that we're talking about being a weapon, right? Being, or not even just being a weapon, but being a tool, you know, this is a tool for influence, and you're seeing the influence really manifest. You know, they take you out of the studio to see it in real life. And that in and of itself, like making that connection is really prescient but scary, you know. And I think it's scary for us on this watch in particular, of course, looking at it in retrospect. I'd be curious to understand how it felt watching it in 1976. Did that feel scary to people watching it? Because that's kind of the point here. It's easier for us to find it scary because of we've seen the results, right? But like, did they watch it and go, whoa, that would be bad, right? You know, like think about us watching a movie about AI going awry, right? Like that's something that we watch and we're like, oh shit, that's scary. But did that feel the same to them? You know, that did this feel like a real threat at that time? I would be curious to know because it's It feels overt to us now, but it feels subtle actually in the connections that it's making.
The only parts where I feel like they went across a line where to me, I think it's hard to say, oh, this isn't satire. The parts that make it me think, yes, it is. Not to say this isn't true today, but when the news hour basically becomes a variety show and they have like the different characters with the different backdrops and stuff. And then the second thing is that violent criminals are part of kind of the news team, like they're produced, they're show business. And there's literally the scene where they're all arguing about, again, like jargon around ratings and who's going to take what share and blah, blah, blah. And there are people with weapons and the dude fires off a handgun. And I think that is supposed to be just like, this is where we're heading, where this is what gets news. So we're just going to loop them in and start paying them too. It's bonkers.
Well, and I think it's also a commentary on like the negotiations happening in that room and the legal machinations that are happening and the how not only how cutthroat they are, but how little they react to it. Right. Like that's an incredibly violent scene. There's a woman who's raging for various reasons, but she's representing a communist movement while making capitalistic machinations in terms of legal decisions, and the negotiations are getting really violent and nobody blinks. Nobody looks twice at any of that.
Spinning off of that to kind of my last two things I wanted to touch on, when you say nobody blinks, nobody thinks twice, the ending of the basically assassination and the we had mentioned throughout this of how real it feels. The fact that there's a narrator and he sounds like a newsman, it kind of is. It's like, hey, I'm telling you this thing that actually happened, even though we now this didn't happen. But it feels more real because of that. But the way that he just says, and thus he died, the first person to be killed for low ratings. And it's just it's a punchline, but it's painful.
It's a punchline and it's funny, but it hurts. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the last couple things that I wanted to touch on was just that. I think there's one beautiful shot just from like a filmmaker perspective when you were talking earlier about the, was it Ned Beatty that you said is the character giving that?
Ned Beatty, yeah.
Ned Beatty. That scene, not only his delivery of him flipping a switch, he turns the lights down and then turns to another level and just is hellfire and brimstone. But the way that is shot, I loved as well, because you've got the close up of Howard sitting there taking it all in, listening. And then when you turn back to Ned's character, it's this long shot of the whole table with all the little green lights and him at the end just turning red in the face and going insane. And I just think that's an incredible sequence.
Yeah, that's the last major sequence I wanted to talk about, not least of which is the delivery to your point, but yes, how it's shot. But I also think it's a very intentional foil to Peter and his speeches, right? His fire and brimstone speeches, but those are in service of and trying to motivate the people who are, quote, the point, right? And this is a person who is, I think him closing the curtains and turning down the lights and all the things are very intentional. He's like, I am letting you in to the secret society. And this is this come to Jesus kind of moment almost, except for come to capitalism, right? And I'm going to give you a speech that is about what we actually are as humans now. And let me just wake you the fuck up. And it is both an incredible delivery and beautifully shot and terrifyingly done, but it is so eloquently written and so accurate. And I won't read the whole thing, but I just do like as a teaser trailer, you guys should go watch this clip. But he's saying there is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
That's heavy.
Heavy shit, right?
I know we're heading toward the eventual like civil war of it's just going to be Amazon and Apple and it's like pick a side.
But like we're joking, but not, right? Because like this is what we are seeing come manifest. Yeah. And like I know we're trying to entertain you guys right now and we wanted to be entertained by this movie, but fuck, this is scary because it's so true.
Yeah.
And
a small handful of people controlling the world's money, media, power, product, everything. Yeah.
And this feels like this terrifying come to Jesus moment because it's snapping you out of your ideals, whatever those are. whether it's democracy or it's society or the power of the people, in whatever way you want to say it, it's taking the power away from you and telling you you never had it to begin with. And so it's a very scary moment for us as individuals, us as a society, and to see how it's really, again, been really prescient. I know we've said it over and over again, but it's alarming how accurate it is. And it's not the only movie to do it, you know, it's, but it is, I think, when we look at the gap of when this came out to now, it correlates so strongly. And I encourage not only you to watch this movie, but certainly to watch that speech, because I think that's the terror, so to speak, that is our existential fight that we are trying to like not let win. But that's the thing that this movie is saying is winning.
Yeah. And just the start to that, he turns the lights. I don't remember it's the very first thing he says after he turns the lights down, but I think it's the first where he turns, flips that switch and becomes angry. And he just goes, "You have meddled." That my eyebrows went up and I was just like, holy shit.
Yeah. In the laws of nature, he says.
Yeah.
He doesn't say you've meddled in my business. You've meddled in this network. Yeah. The laws of nature, he says. Like that's... Dude. Man, and the delivery again, so good. The fire and brimstone of it all is so good. And also we have to say like Peter Finch's response to it, because it does feel like he's cowering. Going through the thing that we are going through as the audience, right? Yeah. You're cowering under the intensity of this speech, and you see him really play that. And his, you know, yeah, as he goes out to this final speech that he gives and ultimately dies, it's like, is his movement dying with him?
Yeah.
You know, is what he's trying to say, and is his message dying with him? And like, it's really, for such a great, beautiful film, it's not, I don't think, intended to end on optimism.
Oh, you know, not at all.
It's meant to end with you feeling a bit of despair.
Yes.
You know, and it's crazy because it's, you know, that's hard to do and have you come out of the theater and go, God, that was a really good movie. You know, like that's hard. That's a hard balance to strike, I think.
100%.
Okay. Anything else before we wrap this up and give our ratings?
I don't think so, dude. I really enjoyed it for a first time watch. I do need to rewatch, because obviously I critiqued a couple of things that I just would have written differently. I just think that the Diana character is more interesting without some of the complications that come with Max, despite that resulting in probably the second best scene in the movie, honestly, with him and his wife. But I'm still going to go pretty high. I'd still give it like an 8. I think it's really fucking good. I just need to give it another watch, honestly.
Yeah, I think it's really good. One last maybe funny nugget before we wrap up that I'll share with y'all is that this movie, there, you know, the writer and the director were really tight in this movie, really did it together. Chayefsky was really involved in how certain lines and things would be delivered, was trying to find the comedy for Lumet. And Lumet even said, like, he's better at comedy than me. But then it got to the divorce scenes and the battles about the divorce. And basically Lumet was like, hold my beer. I know more about divorce
than you.
I got this. Because fun fact, he's been married 4 times at this point. So fun little nugget for you guys before we close out. But I agree. I think it's very well done. It's incredibly well written. And we all know, if y'all have listened to this pod at all, that I'm a sucker for good writing. And it's shot really well. And the fact that it's turned out to be so prescient is, I don't think, a reflective on its initial quality so much as it is our society, but it gives it another layer of impact now, I think, that's interesting. And again, makes me very curious about how people felt about it then. But I think I would go pretty high, especially again, because of the writing. I'd say like an 8.5 or a 9. It's I think a really strong one. And it was interesting one to end on, for sure. All right, homies. Thanks for joining us. That was a fun month. I had a good time. Thanks for joining us and hanging out. Come back next week for some spooky shit. It's October. All right. We're going to do October-y things. We'll tell you more later.
We're recording this on the 13th, guys. So give us a couple weeks to decide.
Give us a minute. Okay. We'll give you more details.
You'll see the episode title. You'll know.
Yeah, you're fine. So anyway, in the meantime,
follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things on Instagram and TikTok. You can get the video of this on YouTube or on Spotify video. And you can always email us. We drink and we watch things pod@gmail.com. We got our 2-year anniversary next month as well. So any questions that you want to throw our way for cold opens and such, or maybe we'll do a bonus episode. Send us any questions you got. Get in touch.
Yep. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.
Cheers. No.